You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, The Secrets of Creation. This is Lecture 7, given on the 23rd of August, 1910, entitled The Structure of the First and Second, in quotes, Days of Creation, The Work of Elemental Beings on Human Organs. In our efforts to understand existence, it is our practice to trace the course of some aspect of its development, and we have had many opportunities of becoming familiar with the idea that everything we perceive around us is in course of evolution. We must get used to applying the idea of evolution on a larger scale in spheres not usually associated with it today. For instance, people hardly think of real evolution with regard to the life of the soul. We probably do recognize it as it manifests outwardly in the life of the individual between birth and death. But so far as humanity as a whole is concerned, people immediately think of evolution as an upward ascent from lower animal forms, and draw the conclusion, a somewhat fanciful one even from the standpoint of what can be known today, that higher organisms can develop from lower ones. The human organism can evolve from animal organisms in an absolutely straightforward way, with no further input. It is, of course, not my task in these lectures to show in detail, as I have often done, that our present consciousness has undergone a large-scale evolution, that the kind of consciousness, the kind of soul life we have today, was preceded by another form of consciousness. We have often described this earlier form as a kind of lower clairvoyant consciousness. With our modern consciousness, external perception provides us with mental pictures of external objects. But that other, earlier form of consciousness can best be studied if we look back to the ancient moon evolution. The most outstanding difference between the evolution of ancient moon and that of our present earth is that the ancient type of clairvoyance, a kind of picture consciousness, has been superseded by the present-day consciousness of objects. For many years I have been calling attention to this, and years ago you were able to read the information I gave from the Akashic Record on the subject of evolution. It appeared in the early essays of the magazine titled Lucifer Gnosis. There I pointed out that the old dreamlike picture consciousness, which we had in former times, has developed into our earthly consciousness, into what today gives us consciousness of external things, of what we call external things in space, in contrast to what we ourselves are in our inner being. This ability to distinguish between external objects and our own inner life is what characterizes our present state of consciousness. When we have an object in front of us, this rose, for instance, we say, quote, this rose is in space. It is separate from us. We are in different places, close quote. We perceive the rose and make a mental picture of it. The mental image is inside us, and the rose is outside. Being able to distinguish between outer things and inner things is the mark of our present-day consciousness. Consciousness on ancient moon was not like that. Beings with an ancient moon consciousness made no such distinction. Suppose that when you looked at the rose, you were not aware that the rose was outside, and that you were making a mental image of it, but that you had an awareness of the rose hovering in space and of its actual essence not being confined to the space it occupied, but spreading outward into space and actually being within you, too. In fact, we could go further. Suppose that when you looked at the sun, you were not conscious of that the sun was up there and you were down here, but that you were aware that while you were forming a mental image of the sun was within you, that you are taking hold of the sun in a more or less spiritual way. Then there would be no distinction between inside and outside. If you can grasp this, then you will have arrived at a real understanding of one of the characteristic qualities of the kind of consciousness which belonged to ancient Moon. Another characteristic of this consciousness was that it was pictorial, so that things did not appear directly as objects, but as symbols, just as dreams often make use of symbols today. For instance, in a dream, a fire external to ourselves appears as the symbol or image of a radiant being. Things were perceived in a similar way by the ancient Moon consciousness, inwardly but also pictorially. It was a pictorial consciousness permeated with the quality of inwardness. And there was yet another essential difference between that consciousness and the one we have today. It did not have the effect at all as though external objects were there. For the ancient Moon consciousness, what we today call our environment, what we perceive as sense objects belonging to the plant, mineral, and human realm, were not there at all. What was there was somewhat similar, though on a lower dreamlike level, to what is experienced in the soul today when the power of seership, clairvoyant consciousness, arises. The first awakening of clairvoyant consciousness is of such a nature that at first it does not extend to external beings. This is a source of countless deceptions for those who, by means of esoteric development, for instance, are developing the gift of clairvoyant faculties. Such a training progresses by stages, of course. There is a first stage of clairvoyance, in which a person develops certain things and sees certain things in his environment. But he would be making a mistake if he were straightway to think that what he perceives in his environment, let us say in spirit space, is actually spiritual reality. In my mystery play, Johannes Thomasius is going through this stage of astral clairvoyance. Let me remind you of the scenes which rise up before his soul as he sits in meditation downstage and feels the spiritual world dawning in his soul. Pictures arise, and the first of these is the spirit of the elements, showing him pictures of people he already knows in life. In the play, Johannes Thomasius has made the acquaintance of Professor Capasius and Dr. Strader. He knows them from the physical plane and has formed certain impressions of them there. When, after going through great pain, his clairvoyant capacity breaks through, he sees them again. In fact, he sees them in strange forms. He sees Capasius as a young man, as he was at the age of 25 or 26, and not as he is at the moment when he, Johannes Thomasius, sits meditating. And he does not see Dr. Strader in the present either, but as he is bound to look when he has become an old man in the present incarnation. These and many other pictures pass through Johannes Thomasius's soul. One can only present this dramatically if the pictures which come alive in the soul in meditation actually appear on the stage. It would be a mistake for Johannes Thomasius to regard this as deception. That would be quite wrong. The only right attitude to all this would be to realize that he cannot yet know to what extent this is deception or reality. He does not know whether what the pictures are showing him is an external spiritual reality or not. That is, he does not know whether it is something inscribed in the Akashic record, or whether he has expanded his own self to make a world. It could be both of these, and he must recognize that fact. What he lacks is the gift to distinguish between spiritual reality and picture consciousness. He has to admit that. And it is not until the moment when devachanic consciousness sets in, when in devachan he perceives the spiritual reality of a person whom he knows on the physical plane, Maria, that he is able to look back and to discriminate between reality and what is simply picture consciousness. Thus you can see that in the course of his esoteric development, a human being has to pass through a stage in which he is surrounded by pictures, but is quite unable to distinguish between manifestations of spiritual reality and the pictures themselves. The scenes of the mystery play reveal, of course, real spiritual realities. For instance, the way Professor Capasius appears is a true picture of the young Capasius, as inscribed in the Akashic record. And the way Dr. Strotter appears is the real Strotter, as he will be in old age. In the play, they are meant to be real. Only Johannes Thomasius does not know that the figures he sees are real. The stage of consciousness I have described was experienced on ancient moon, only at a lower, more dreamlike level, so that no faculty of discrimination was possible. The ability to discriminate only began later. And you must thoroughly familiarize yourselves with what I have just said. Let us hang on to the fact that the clairvoyant lives his way into a kind of picture consciousness. But during the ancient moon evolution, the pictures which arose were in the main quite different from the objects of our earthly consciousness. And the same thing applies today in the early stages of clairvoyance. The clairvoyant does not at first see external spiritual beings at all. He sees pictures, and the question is, what do these pictures signify? You know, in the first stages of clairvoyance, they are not expressions of real external spiritual beings at all, but, if I may say so, a kind of organ consciousness. This is a pictorial presentation, a projection in space of what is actually going on inside ourselves. And as the clairvoyant begins to develop these forces in himself, he can, to give an actual example, have the feeling he is perceiving two luminous globes far away in space. Two pictures, that is, of globes shining brightly in certain colors. If he were, then, to think to himself, quote, somewhere outside me there are two beings, close quote, the probability is that he would be quite wrong. At any rate, that would be the case to begin with. For the fact is that his clairvoyance is projecting outward into space forces which are at work in himself, and seeing them as two globes. These two globes could represent what is at work in his astral body, bringing about in him the power of sight in his two eyes. This power of sight can be projected outward in the form of two globes. In actual fact, it is inner forces which are presenting themselves as external phenomena in astral space. And it would be the greatest mistake for something like this to be taken to herald the external presence of spiritual beings. It would be a still greater error if right from the beginning, with the help of a little bit of questionable assistance, one were to hear voices and immediately interpret them as inspiration from outside. This is the greatest error to which one can fall prey. It will hardly be anything else but an echo of an inner process. And while what appears in images of color and form usually represents fairly sound inner processes, voices are, as a rule, signs of pretty chaotic things going on in the soul. The best thing for anyone to do who begins hearing voices is to cultivate the greatest mistrust in what they say. So you see that the beginning of pictorial imagery must, under all circumstances, be undertaken with the greatest care. It is a kind of organ consciousness, a projection of one's own inner being into space. During the ancient moon evolution, it was normal that the consciousness possessed then was a consciousness of the organs. At the moon stage, human beings scarcely perceived anything beyond what was happening within them at the time. I have often recalled an important saying of Goethe, quote, "The eye was formed by the light for the light," close quote, EYE. This saying should be taken extremely seriously. All organs we human beings have were formed by our environment. And philosophy is being very superficial if it only stresses one half of the truth, namely that without eyes human beings could not perceive light. For the other important half of the truth is that without light, eyes could never have developed. And similarly, without sound, there would have been no ears. Looked at from a deeper point of view, Kantianism is altogether superficial, because it only presents half the truth. The light weaving and flooding through cosmic space is the cause of the organs of sight. During the ancient moon evolution, the main task of the beings who took part in the upbuilding of our universe was the construction of our organs. First, these organs have to be constructed, and then they are able to perceive. Our present objective consciousness is due to the fact that, first of all, the organs were constructed. The sense organs, as purely physical organs, were constructed as early as ancient Saturn, with the eye somewhat like the photographer's camera obscura. Purely physical apparatuses such as these can perceive nothing. They are constructed according to purely physical laws. During the ancient moon evolution, these organs were internalized. With regard to the eye, EYE, we have to say that on ancient Saturn it was constructed to the extent that it was at most just a physical apparatus. At the moon stage, through the sunlight shining in from outside, it was transformed into an organ of perception, an organ of consciousness. The essential thing about this activity during the ancient moon evolution is that our organs were, so to say, drawn forth. During Earth evolution, the important thing is that light, for instance, influences the plants from outside and maintains their development. We see in the flora around us the product of this activity of the light. During the ancient moon evolution, light did not act in this way. It drew forth our organs. And what human beings perceived at that time was this work on their own organs. It was a perceiving of pictures, though these pictures appeared to be spread out in cosmic space. They were in fact nothing else than the expressions of the activity being carried out by the elements upon human organs. What the human being perceived during the ancient moon evolution was his own construction, developing, as it were, out of his own being. He perceived his seeing eyes, the work being done in the course of his own inner becoming. Thus the outer world was an inner world, because the entire outer world was working on his inner being. And he made no distinction between what was outside and what was inside. He did not perceive the sun as an external object. He did not separate the sun from himself, but felt within himself his eyes coming into existence. And this active growth of his eyes expanded for him into a pictorial perception which filled space. This was how he perceived the sun, but it was an inner process. The characteristic thing about moon consciousness was that the human being perceived a world of pictures around him, but these pictures represented inner growth, an inner building up of soul life. On moon, then, the human being was enveloped in astral existence and felt his own development to be an outer world. Nowadays, it would be pathological to perceive this inner development as an outer world, so that one could not distinguish these pictures of the world outside, which one is perceiving only as a reflection of one's own growth. But during the ancient moon evolution, it was the normal state of affairs. Human beings perceived within their own being the activity of those beings who later became the Elohim. They perceived their activity, somewhat as today we might perceive your blood flowing within you. It was within him, but it was reflected in pictures coming from outside. But on ancient Moon, such a consciousness was altogether the only one possible. For what happens on our Earth has to happen in harmony with the whole cosmos. A consciousness such as human beings have on Earth, with this distinction between what is outside and inside, with the perception of real objects being there outside us, as well as the perception of our also having an inner being, calling for the whole evolutionary transition from Moon to Earth, and quite a different form of separation occurred in our cosmic system. The kind of separation such as we have today between Moon and Earth was not there at all during the ancient Moon evolution. We have to think of what we call ancient Moon as though today's Moon were still united with the Earth. So all the other planets, including the Sun, were quite differently constituted, and under the conditions of those times, only a picture consciousness of that kind was possible. It was only after our whole cosmos had assumed the form it has as our Earth environment that our present objective consciousness could develop. So we must say that a consciousness such as human beings have on Earth today was reserved for them until Earth evolution. Not only did human beings not have it, but nor did any of the other beings whom we speak of as belonging to one hierarchy or another. It would be foolish to think that because the angels passed through their human stage on ancient Moon, they must therefore have had the kind of consciousness there that humankind has today on Earth. This was not so. And this distinguishes them from human beings in that they went through their human stage with another consciousness. There is never a direct repetition of past circumstances. Each evolutionary impulse happens once only, and it happens for its own sake, and not for the sake of repeating something. Therefore, to produce what we know today as earthly human consciousness, all the processes which have actually brought this earth about were needed, and also the human being as he is today. It was impossible for such a form of consciousness to develop at an earlier stage of evolution. When we confront an object, it is outside us and appears to us as an entity external to us. All previous kinds of consciousness belonging to any of the beings we can name made no distinction between what is outside and what is inside, so that it would have been nonsense for any of them to say, quote, "Something is appearing in front of me," close quote. Even the Elohim could not say that, for they had no such experience. They could only say, quote, "We move and have our being in the cosmos. We create. And in creating are aware of this, our creation. There are no objects in front of us. No objects appear before us," close quote. To say, quote, "objects appear in front of us," close quote, conveys a situation in which we are confronted by something real formed in an external space from which we ourselves are separated. This did not come about even for the Elohim until Earth evolution. During the Moon evolution, when these Elohim felt themselves weaving and working in the light which streamed from the Sun upon Moon, they might have said to themselves, quote, "We feel our existence in this light. We feel ourselves descending along with this light into the beings who on ancient Moon are at the human level. We speed through space with this light," close quote. But they could never have said, quote, "We see this light outside ourselves," close quote. There was nothing like that during the Moon evolution. That was a totally new occurrence belonging to the Earth. When at a certain stage of evolution in Genesis, the momentous words occur, quote, "And God said, let there be light," close quote, a new occurrence has to come about. That the Elohim will not continue only to feel themselves flowing with the light, but that the light is raying back to them from objects that appear to them from outside. This is expressed by the writer of Genesis. When to the words, quote, "And God said, let there be light," close quote, he adds, quote, "And God saw the light," close quote. In this ancient document, nothing is superfluous. Nothing is meaningless. We could wish that among many other things, people could learn from this document to write down nothing that is not pregnant with meaning, nothing that is merely empty words. The writer of Genesis wrote nothing that was unnecessary, nothing by way of commonplace embellishment to enhance the beauty of the creation of light. He does not make the Elohim say anything like, quote, "We see the light and are pleased with ourselves that we have done it well," close quote. The point of this brief statement is that something new has to come about. And it says even more than this. It does not only say, quote, "And God saw the light," close quote, but that he saw that it was beautiful or good. I realize that in the Hebrew tongue, there was not the distinction between beautiful and good that there is today. The Hebrew language has the same word for good as for beautiful. What is actually meant when people call something beautiful or good? In ancient Sanskrit, even in German, there is still an echo of what is meant. The word beautiful covers all words in all languages which mean that an inner spiritual element appears in an external image. To be beautiful means that an inner quality appears outwardly. And the best concept we can connect with the word beauty today is to hold fast to the idea that in the beautiful object an inner spiritual reality is being presented in a physical image on the surface, so to speak. We call something beautiful when we, as it were, see the spiritual element appearing in sense-perceptible form. When does a marble statue become a thing of beauty? When, through its outer form, it produces the illusion that living spirit is in it. Beauty is the appearance of spirit in external form. So when, in Genesis, we come to the words, quote, "God saw the light," close quote, we can say that they convey the specific quality of earth evolution, but also that what could formerly only be experienced subjectively now appears externally, that the spirit presents itself in its outer manifestation. So the words which are usually translated as, quote, "And God saw the light, and he saw that it was good," close quote, can be paraphrased as, quote, "And the Elohim experienced the consciousness that the element in which they previously existed now confronted them externally, and in this external phenomenon, they experienced that the spirit was in the background expressing itself in the outer object," close quote. For this is what the word beautiful or good means. Wordy explanations will not help us to understand Genesis. What will help will be to keep our eyes open all the time for the secrets which are actually concealed in the words themselves. Then research will yield rich fruits. Whereas all too many interpretations are nothing but tiresome pedantry. But let us go a bit further. We saw that the characteristic features of moon evolution could only arise because the sun separated from the moon. And we appreciated the fact that during Earth evolution, the sun had also to separate from the earth, that a duality is essential for the existence of conscious being. The earth element had to withdraw. But a withdrawal of this kind involves something else, namely, that the elemental conditions change with regard to both the moon and the sun. If you make a study of our present sun, even from a purely physical aspect, you are obliged to say that the conditions which we have on earth, and which we call solid and liquid, are not to be found on the physical sun. The most you can say is that the sun descends as far as the gaseous state. This is recognized even by modern physics. Such a splitting up of elemental conditions comes about through the separation of what was previously a unity. We saw that the earth element develops in such a way that a kind of downward densification takes place from warmth right down to solid matter, and that the upper elements, light, ether, sound, life ether, seem to press inward from outside. However, we must not assume that a similar pattern occurs on the departing sun element. We had better have another look at the seven conditions of elemental existence. The first of these, the most rarefied state, is the one which contains and brings about life. Then comes what we can call number or sound ether, then light ether, and then warmth ether, and then we have air or gas, then water, and finally earth or solid matter. In the earth realm, we shall find mainly the elements up as far as warmth. Warmth permeates our earth, whereas the earth only shares in the light insofar as the beings in its environment, or if you like, the bodies in its environment, take part in the life of the earth. Light streams from the sun into the earth. If we want to locate the three higher elemental states, light ether, sound ether, and life ether, we shall find them more in the region of the sun. It is in the earth sphere that we shall find the solid, fluid, and gaseous elements, whereas warmth is spread over both the earth and the sun spheres. Light, spiritual sound, and life should be allotted more to the sun. The forces that produce life belong more to the sun. The first time this sun realm became separated was during the ancient moon evolution. It was then that the light was for the first time active from without, but not then as light. I have just told you that the statement in Genesis, quote, "and God saw the light," close quote, could not possibly have been spoken with regard to the moon evolution. Then one would have had to say that the Elohim speeded through space with the light, were within the light, but saw it not. Just as today someone swimming in water moves forward in it without seeing it, at that time light was invisible, for it was a carrier of activity in cosmic space. It was with the coming of Earth evolution that light began to appear, to be reflected by objects. It was a natural further development that the situation regarding light during the moon evolution should apply with regard to a somewhat higher condition during the earth evolution. We must expect that what applied to light on ancient moon should during earth evolution apply to the sound ether. In other words, the same thing happens with sound ether during earth evolution that happened during the moon evolution with light ether. This would imply that the Elohim do not perceive the reflection of what we call spiritual sound in the same way as they do with light. Therefore, if Genesis wanted to convey that evolution was advancing from light ether being active to sound ether being active, it would have to say something like, quote, "and the Elohim saw the light in the developing earth and saw that it was beautiful," close quote. But it could not continue in the same vein and say, quote, "and during this phase the Elohim perceived the sound ether," close quote, but would have to say, quote, "they moved and had their being in it," close quote. Nor could it be said of the second day of creation that the Elohim perceived the agitated movement separating the elements above from those below. This activity of the Elohim could not be described as something they perceived. The words perceive and beautiful had to be omitted in Genesis. Then the description would correspond with what can be observed through spiritual science. That is, the seer who wrote the Genesis account had, when describing the second day, to omit the words, quote, "and God saw," close quote. Now, look at Genesis. On the first day, it says, quote, "and God saw the light, that it was good," close quote. On the second day of creation, you find in the most usual translations that it says, after the first day has ended, quote, and God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. Close quote. And the statement, quote, and God saw, close quote, which is said of the first day, is omitted on the second day. Genesis describes the facts as we should expect them to be from what we have been able to observe through the spiritual scientific method. Here again is a knotty problem that the 19th, knotty spelled K-N-O-T-T-Y, here again is a knotty problem that the 19th century commentators have not known what to make of. Some of them have said, what of it if the words are omitted the second time? The writer must have forgotten to put them in. People should learn from Genesis that it not only records nothing irrelevant, but also that it omits nothing that is relevant. The writer has not forgotten anything. There is the deepest reason why these words are not there for the second day of creation. Here we have another example, and I could quote a great many, of the kind of thing that fills us with immense appreciation and respect for a document like Genesis. We could learn a great deal from these ancient writers, who really did not need to pledge an oath, for once they recognized the truth, they followed of their own accord the principle of telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth. They felt through and through that every word that stands there must be sacred to us, and equally that nothing essential must be omitted. We have now gained an insight, a spiritual insight, so to speak, into the composition of what was called the first and second days of creation. Anyone who discovers, through spiritual investigation, what is behind these things might well say to himself on turning to his Bible, quote, how wonderful it would be, overwhelmingly wonderful, if these subtle details, which can be discovered by conscientious spiritual investigation, should be corroborated by the words of the ancient seer who took part in the making of Genesis, close quote. And when he finds that this overwhelming hope is verified, a wonderful feeling comes over him, a kind of feeling which should indeed fill our inner soul, if we are once more to appreciate the sacredness of this ancient document, Genesis. The end of Lecture 7.